This is a When Walls Can Talk network podcast.
All right. Hello again, dear listeners. Jeremy here, and I want to start today's journey with a heartfelt moment of gratitude. I recently received a message on Instagram that truly has just meant so much to me. A listener wrote, "Hello, Audio Magician. Your podcast is a spellbinding experience, conjuring pure magic with every episode." To the wonderful soul who sent that message, and to all of you who turn in episode after episode, thank you. It's just messages like these that remind me of the purpose behind this podcast and each story that we delve into. My goal here with every tale, every echo from the past, is to transport you to a moment in time. A moment where the stories of our past and the humanity that thrived in these paranormal locations can breathe once more. Through these tales, we not only honor the spirits of the past, but also learn invaluable lessons about our present. So together, we embark on a journey to become better stewards of mankind, our rich and complex history, and the mysterious supernatural that surrounds us. If today's episode resonates with you, or if you find yourself transported or learn something new, I would be so honored if you'd leave us a review. And for those of you on Instagram, take a moment to screenshot your podcast player and tag @whenwallscantalk with underscores for spaces, and I'd love to connect with you and thank you personally. And then we can dive deep into your favorite parts and theories behind the legends that we explore here on the show. Lastly, if you want to be one of the cool kids, click the link in the bottom of our show notes and join my email list. Coming in November, I'm launching the Spirit Box, finally, which is a monthly newsletter for witches by witches, which will feature each month's upcoming astrological calendar, special ritual prompts and tarot spreads for you to try on your own at home, spotlights on a monthly herb in our herb corner, poetry, short stories, paranormal experiences from our listeners, and a whole lot more. So definitely do not miss out. But now that I've sold myself to you a little bit, let's shift gears. Let's rewind the clock and embark on today's many tales. Are you ready for our journey through time? In the heart of London, on a night devoid of moonlight, the Thames exhaled a fog so dense it seemed to carry with it the whispers of bygone eras. Rising from this spectral mist, the Tower of London stood, its ancient stones pulsating with tales as old as time. Drawn to its magnetic pull, a lone wanderer stepped through its archaic gates. Each footfall on the cobblestones echoed with the weight of history, until an unexpected chill, sharp and penetrating, halted her in her tracks. From the swirling fog emerged a vision. A woman, resplendent in Tudor elegance, yet hauntingly absent of a face. She glided, a silent apparition, her very essence freezing the surrounding air before dissipating back into the mists of time. This wasn't just a fleeting shadow. It was the tragic Queen Anne Boleyn, her spirit forever tethered to the tower's legacy. The Tower of London, a monument, relic, a witness. It has seen kings and queens, traitors and heroes, mysteries and revelations. Its walls have absorbed a millennium of laughter, tears, schemes and dreams. But what truths lie behind these walls? What stories are whispered in the corridors, and how do these tales from the past resonate with our lives today? In the shadows of this fortress, two young princes vanished without a trace, their fate a mystery that has puzzled historians for centuries. Within these walls, spies met their end during the world wars, their secrets forever sealed. And beneath the tower, in its cold, dark dungeons, tales of torture and treachery abound, echoing the darker side of human nature. Yet amidst these tales of sorrow and betrayal, there are stories of love, honor, and resilience. The tower has been a silent observer to the ever-changing tapestry of English history, from the Norman conquest to the present day. It has witnessed the rise and fall of empires, the ebb and flow of power, and the dreams and ambitions of countless souls. Join me as we journey through time, uncovering the secrets of this ancient fortress, and perhaps discovering truths about ourselves along the way. Stories that challenge our understanding of power, legacy, and destiny. Stories that remind us that walls, no matter how old, have tales to tell, if only we listen closely. I'm Jeremy Haig, and this is When Walls Can Talk. Throughout the ages, man has repeated the same earnest saying, more of a question really, or perhaps even a plea, if these walls could talk. But what if they do, and always have? Perhaps their stories, memories, and messages are all around us, if only we would take the moment to listen. On this podcast, we reinvestigate legends and tales of the past and allow the echoes of their lessons to live on once again, informing us, educating us, and sharing new and unique insight into the inner workings of the paranormal and spiritual world. Will you dare to listen? This is When Walls Can Talk, the podcast. The year is 1066. England was a haven untouched by the modern world. A verdant tapestry of rolling hills, where wildflowers danced with the wind, and dense, mysterious forests whispered secrets from ages past. Villages dotted the landscape, each a bustling hub of life, where the blacksmith's anvil rang in harmony with the minstrel's song. The people of this time led simple yet profound lives. Their days were governed by the rising and setting of the sun, the changing of the seasons, and the ancient traditions passed down through generations. The markets were alive with the aroma of fresh bread, the clatter and chatter of trades, and the vibrant colors of hand-woven fabrics. Stone churches, with their towering spires, stood as beacons of faith, while mead halls echoed with tales of valor and romance. Yet beneath this tapestry of daily life, a sense of anticipation hung heavy in the air. Whispers of change, of a force from across the sea, began to stir the hearts and minds of the people. From the misty shores of Normandy, a formidable power was amassing, led by a duke with ambition in his eyes and a destiny to fulfill. This was an England on the cusp of transformation, a land where ancient traditions would soon collide with new aspirations. The very soul of the nation stood at a crossroads, awaiting the events that would forever alter the course of English history. To truly understand the seismic shift that was about to shake the foundations of England in 1066, we must first journey to the heart of Normandy. Here, in a land of chivalry and strategy, a man of unparalleled ambition was rising to power. William, the Duke of Normandy, was not just any noble. Known to history as William the Conqueror, he bore a title that spoke of his destiny. And in a twist of personal irony, he happens to be one of my own ancestors. But who was this man who would dare to challenge the might of the English throne? Born out of wedlock, William's early life was marked by challenges. Yet, with each obstacle, his resolve only grew stronger. By the time he became the Duke, he had transformed into a formidable leader, with an army that would follow him to the ends of the earth. And it was this army, this force of unwavering loyalty, that William led across the English Channel. Their destination, a land of ancient traditions and proud warriors. As they marched through the English countryside, the weight of destiny pressed upon them, leading them to a battlefield that would become the stuff of legends. On the opposing side stood Harold Godwinson, the English king. A man of valor and pride, Harold was the embodiment of Anglo-Saxon resilience. But fate, as it often does, had other plans. As the two armies clashed in the Battle of Hastings, an arrow piercing the sky and finding its mark in Harold's eye would signal the end of an era. With Harold's fall, the sun set on the Anglo-Saxon reign, making way for a new dawn under Norman rule. Victory on the battlefield, as monumental as it may be, is but a fleeting moment in the grand context of history. For William, the conqueror of Normandy, the true test lay ahead. Conquest was merely the prologue. The chapters that followed would determine the legacy of his reign. To truly leave an indelible mark, to etch one's name in the bedrock of history, one needed more than just an army. One needed symbols, towering edifices that would cast long shadows, not just on the land, but on the very psyche of its people. Where the mighty River Thames flows with timeless grace, on its north bank of bustling London, William envisioned a fortress. But this was to be no ordinary fortress. It was to be a testament, a monument to Norman dominance and the dawn of a new era. Every stone laid, every tower erected was a message to the people of England and to the world that here stood a ruler with a might and vision to shape history. The Tower of London, as it would come to be known, was not just a stronghold. It was a declaration. A declaration that echoed the words of William himself.
Here I stand, unyielding, dominant, eternal.
As the years following the conquest rolled on, the heart of London bore witness to a transformation unlike any other. By 1078, amidst the familiar structures of the city, a new edifice began to command attention. Its presence undeniable. Its grandeur unparalleled. The White Tower, aptly named for its radiant facade, stood as the crowning jewel of William's fortress. Rising majestically, it dominated the London skyline, a beacon of Norman vision and determination. But what truly set the White Tower apart was not just its height or its design, but the very material from which it was crafted. Gleaming white Caen stone had been transported with immense effort from the heart of Normandy. Each block, each slab was a symbol of the meticulous planning and sheer will that went into the tower's creation. In a city where wood was the primary building material, the White Tower's stone facade was a stark contrast, a deliberate choice. It was a statement of permanence, of endurance. Its walls, robust and seemingly impervious, spoke volumes of the engineering prowess of the Normans and the unyielding ambition of their leader. Symbols of power like the tower have shaped societies for centuries. They stand as reminders of who holds the reins of control, of the victories and defeats of ages past, and of the ever-shifting sands of time. As we stand in the shadow of the White Tower, its ancient stones bearing the weight of centuries, a question emerges, beckoning us to look beyond its walls and into the heart of our own existence. In the vast tapestry of human history, every era, every culture has its towers. Edifices that rise above the mundane, symbols that capture the essence of their time. Today, as we navigate the labyrinth of our modern world, what are the structures that define us? Is it the soaring skyscrapers reaching for the stars, reflecting our aspirations? Or perhaps the grand monuments, standing as silent witnesses to our triumphs and tragedies? And in this digital age, where information is power, Do we not also build fortresses in cyberspace? Digital citadels that guard our secrets, our identities, our very essence. As we journey on through the tower's history, we are privy to tales that resonate across eras. Stories of ambition and desire, of love that defies boundaries, of betrayals that change the course of nations. These narratives, spanning from the days of William the Conqueror to the pulse of the present, serve as touchstones of the cyclical dance of power. Empires rise, kingdoms fall, yet the human spirit, with its dreams and dilemmas, remains constant. So as we stand at this crossroads of history and reflection, let's ponder a moment. The towers we erect, both tangible and intangible, what do they reveal about our essence? How do these symbols of bygone eras influence our today? And more importantly, how will they mold the tomorrows yet to come? For now, let's take a breath. Look inward and ask, in the grand narrative of our lives, what are the monuments we are building? And when future generations gaze upon them, what tales will they tell? In the grand saga of the tower's stories, there are some that chill the bone, that linger in the mind long after they've been told. Among these, the tale of two young princes stands out, casting a shadow that has endured for centuries. Imagine, if you will, a time of political intrigue and power plays. At the heart of this storm were two innocent souls. Edward V, a young boy of just 12, and his tender brother Richard, merely 9. Sons of the late King Edward IV, they were the rightful heirs to the English throne, but destiny, it seems, had penned a different story for them. With the untimely demise of their father, Edward was poised to wear the crown. The Tower of London, traditionally a place of preparation for coronations, became their temporary home. Yet as the days meandered on, a palpable tension gripped the air. The once frequent sightings of the playful princes diminished, their laughter echoing less and less in the stone corridors until one fateful day, silence. The heart of London was abuzz with whispers. Every alley, every tavern, every market square echoed with the same haunting question. Where were the princes? Rumors, dark and foreboding, spread like a plague. Had tragedy befallen the young heirs? And if so, who could commit such a heinous act? Eyes turned suspiciously towards their uncle, Richard III, described by many of his contemporaries as a man of unbridled ambition. His ascent to the throne, in the absence of the princes, did little to quell the murmurs. But could he, a man of royal blood, truly harm his own kin? Or was there another, even darker tale lurking in the shadows? The mystery of the princes in the tower is a tale that has both fascinated and haunted England for generations. Despite the passage of time erasing many traces and countless investigations weaving myriad theories, the true fate of these young souls remains lost, a poignant reminder of the mysteries that history often conceals in its folds. These stories of the princes in the tower, Edward V and his younger brother Richard, has captivated historians and the public for centuries. While their sudden disappearance remains a subject of intense debate, there are other chilling tales associated with their story. The Tower of London, where the princes were last seen, is notorious for its ghostly apparitions. Among the many spirits said to haunt the ancient fortress, the figures of two young boys, often seen in nightgowns and holding hands, are frequently reported. These apparitions are believed to be the restless souls of the two princes, wandering the tower's cold stone corridors, perhaps in search of justice, or simply, a way out. In a chilling development in 1674, workmen at the Tower of London made a gruesome discovery. While excavating under a staircase, they unearthed a wooden box containing two small human skeletons. Given the location and the age of the bones, many believed they had stumbled upon the remains of the lost princes. King Charles II, perhaps hoping to finally put the matter to rest, ordered the bones to be interred in Westminster Abbey. They were placed in an urn designed by the famed architect Christopher Wren, and to this day, they rest in the hallowed confines of the abbey. However, the discovery raised more questions than it answered. Were these truly the remains of the princes? And if so, how did they die? And perhaps most hauntingly, who was responsible for their deaths? While the bones were examined in 1933, the results were inconclusive. They were found to belong to two children of the right ages, but many bones were missing, and no further scientific examinations, like DNA testing, have been conducted. The tales of blood and stone don't end there. Oh no. The tower has seen its fair share of heartbreak and horror. Henry VIII, one of England's most infamous monarchs, is often remembered for his six marriages and his role in the English Reformation. However, his reign was also marked by political intrigue, power struggles, and a penchant for dealing ruthlessly with perceived threats. Among the many who found themselves in the crosshairs of the king's wrath was Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey. Henry Howard was no ordinary nobleman. As a member of the powerful Howard family, he was closely related to two of Henry VIII's wives, Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard, both of whom met tragic ends, which we will get to. Surrey himself was a talented poet, soldier, and courtier, known for introducing the sonnet form to English literature. But his brilliance and lineage would also make him a target. In the later years of Henry VIII's reign, the king's health was deteriorating, and the question of succession loomed large. The court became a hotbed of conspiracies and jockeying for power. Surrey, with his noble blood and connections, was seen by many as a potential claimant to the throne, especially given the uncertainties surrounding the young Prince Edward's ability to rule. On December 12, 1546, Henry Howard was arrested and imprisoned in the Tower of London. The charges against him were serious. Treason, based on allegations that he had used the royal arms in his personal heraldry, implying a claim to the throne. The evidence was flimsy at best, but in the paranoid atmosphere of Henry VIII's court, it was more than enough. Howard's trial was a foregone conclusion. Despite his passionate defense and the lack of concrete evidence, he was found guilty. The sentence was death. Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, was not just a talented poet and courtier, but also a man of resourcefulness and determination. As he languished in the Tower of London, awaiting a fate that seemed all but sealed, he devised a daring plan to escape his grim destiny. Imprisoned in St. Thomas's Tower, Howard surveyed his surroundings for any potential means of escape. His keen eyes settled on the latrine shaft, which emptied into the River Thames. This shaft, which relied on the river's tides to flush out its contents, presented a potential vulnerability in the otherwise impregnable fortress. The plan was audacious. Howard would descend through the latrine shaft, making his way to the Thames below. From there, he could potentially swim or find a boat to whisk him away to safety, but the timing was crucial. The tide had to be at just the right level. Low enough for him to make his escape, yet not so low that he'd be stranded in the mud. On the fateful night of his planned escape in January 1547, Howard waited for the opportune moment. Just minutes after midnight, with the tide at the perfect level, he began his treacherous descent towards the river. His freedom was tantalizingly close. As Howard was making his way down, the guards began their nightly rounds. Noticing his absence from his cell, they quickly began a search. As they approached the latrine shaft, they caught a glimpse of Howard, only his fingertips still visible as he tried to make his way down. The guards acted swiftly, grabbing hold of his hands and hauling Howard back up, thwarting his escape just moments before it would have been successful. The bold attempt, while commendable, sealed his fate even further. On January 19th, 1547, Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, was executed by beheading on Tower Hill. A tragic end for one of England's finest poets and courtiers. His father, the Duke of Norfolk, was also set to be executed, but in a twist of fate, King Henry VIII died the day before the scheduled execution, and the Duke's life was spared by the succeeding monarch, Edward VI. The story of Henry Howard is a reminder of the dangers of courtly life during the Tudor era, where ambition, envy, and the whims of a capricious monarch could seal one's fate. It also underscores the bloodthirsty and often unpredictable nature of Henry VIII, a king whose legacy is as much about his tyrannical rule as it is about his role in shaping the course of English history. And while we're on the subject of escape attempts, there's another infamous one I should tell you about. In the late 16th century, England was a nation divided by religious strife. Queen Elizabeth I, a staunch Protestant, was determined to eradicate Catholicism from her realm. This religious crackdown led to the covert operations of the Jesuits, a group of Catholic priests working in the shadows to keep their faith alive. Among them was John Gerard, a man of deep conviction and courage. Disguised as a nobleman, Gerard moved through the highest echelons of English society, secretly converting many to Catholicism. His work was dangerous, for the Queen's spies were everywhere, and the penalty for spreading the Catholic faith was severe. Yet, Gerard's dedication to his mission was unwavering. However, in 1597, his secret life was exposed. Arrested and brought to the infamous Tower of London, Gerard was imprisoned in the Salt Tower, a grim and foreboding structure embedded within the fortress's inner defensive wall. His capture was a significant blow to the Catholic underground, for Gerard was not just any priest. He was deeply connected, a linchpin in the covert Catholic network. The Tower's torturers, well-versed in the art of pain, were determined to extract from Gerard the names of his fellow Jesuits. They knew that breaking him would deal a significant blow to the Catholic resistance. Gerard himself recounted the horrors he faced in that dark, underground chamber, a place where hope seemed to die, and where the very air was thick with despair. His description paints a chilling picture, a solemn procession leading him to a room filled with instruments of torture, each more terrifying than the last. The manacles, designed to dislocate joints and render the victim helpless, were used on Gerard with ruthless efficiency. Hours would pass, with Gerard's body bearing the full weight of the torture, his joints slowly giving away, pain consuming every fiber of his being. Yet, even in the face of such unimaginable suffering, Gerard's spirit remained unbroken. Despite the agony, despite the pressure, he refused to betray his fellow Jesuits. His captors, frustrated and enraged, could not break his resolve. The Salt Tower, with its imposing stone walls and narrow windows, was designed to be an inescapable prison. But for Gerard, a man of unwavering faith and determination, surrender was never an option. As the days turned into weeks, Gerard's resilience and spirit began to have an effect on his guard. The relentless torture he endured evoked sympathy, and slowly, the guard began to grant him small liberties. One such liberty was the permission to visit John Arden, another Catholic prisoner held in the Cradle Tower, a structure located just across the courtyard. Arden, imprisoned for a decade, was a kindred spirit, and the two men quickly formed a bond. Their shared faith and circumstances became the foundation of a daring plan. The Cradle Tower's proximity to the River Thames presented an opportunity. If Gerard could somehow communicate with his allies outside the tower, they might be able to orchestrate an escape. Inspiration struck when Gerard received a gift of oranges. Using the citric acid from the orange juice, he devised an ingenious method to send covert messages. By carving crucifixes from the orange peels and wrapping them in seemingly innocuous prayers written in charcoal, he concealed his true messages, written in invisible ink on the reverse side. When heated, the hidden messages would reveal themselves, a testament to Tudor ingenuity. With this method, Gerard was able to coordinate with his contacts outside the tower. They planned to bring a boat to the wharf on the night of October 3rd, 1597. As the evening shadows deepened, Gerard and Arden made their move. Using cords and weights, they secured a long rope to their position on the roof. With the Thames below and freedom beckoning, Arden descended first, followed by Gerard, who, despite his agony and his tortured wrists and joints, managed to make the perilous descent. Their escape was nothing short of miraculous. Gerard, once a prisoner subjected to unimaginable torture, found his way back to Europe, where he lived out the rest of his days in relative peace. Though his injuries made writing a painful endeavor, he managed to dictate his memoirs, ensuring that his incredible tale of faith, resilience, and escape would be remembered for generations to come. But who was the first person to lose their head to the wrath of the king at the Tower of London? That honor falls to Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn's story is one of passion, ambition, and tragedy. Her tale is intricately woven into the fabric of England's history, and her legacy is a testament to the volatile nature of courtly love and politics in the Tudor era. Born into the ambitious Boleyn family, Anne was educated in the Netherlands and France, which was unusual for women of her time. This European education equipped her with a sharp intellect, a flair for the arts, and a cosmopolitan charm that would later captivate the English court. When she returned to England, her grace, wit, and unique style quickly caught the attention of many, but none more so than King Henry VIII. Henry, initially married to Catherine of Aragon for over two decades, had grown desperate for a male heir. Catherine had borne him a daughter, Mary, but no sons who survived infancy. Anne, with her youthful allure and promise of new beginnings, became the object of Henry's intense affection. Their courtship was filled with secret letters, clandestine meetings, and a passion that would reshape the religious landscape of England. To marry Anne, Henry broke away from the Catholic Church, establishing the Church of England, a decision that sent shockwaves through Europe. On the 30th of May, 1533, the Tower of London, an emblematic symbol of power and might, witnessed a spectacle like none other. Anne Boleyn, soon to be crowned Queen of England, made her grand entrance. The ancient fortress, which had stood witness to countless historical events, had undergone a massive transformation in anticipation of her arrival. It wasn't just any renovation. It was a metamorphosis befitting of a queen. King Henry VIII, in his bid to woo and honor Anne, had ensured that the tower was refurbished to reflect her tastes and preferences. The most striking addition were the onion-shaped domes, a nod to the French architectural style that Anne so dearly loved. These domes, which stand out even today, were a testament to Henry's dedication to making Anne feel cherished and esteemed. Historical records from that time paint a vivid picture of the tower's transformation. It was described that the old fortress put on its gala apparel and became splendid for the new queen's coronation. It wasn't just a mere change in decor. It was a symbol of the shifting dynamics of power and the ascendancy of Anne Boleyn. While most women of the era might receive tokens of affection in the form of flowers or chocolates, Anne Boleyn was in a league of her own. She was presented with a magnificent palace, nestled within the formidable walls of the Tower of London. This grand gesture was not just a wedding gift, but a declaration of Henry's unwavering devotion and the pivotal role Anne was set to play in English history. But royal love stories, especially those as controversial as Henry and Anne's, rarely have fairy tale endings. Only after about 3 years of their marriage, the union turned sour. The pressure on Anne to produce a male heir was immense. She gave birth to a daughter, the future Queen Elizabeth I, but subsequent pregnancies ended in miscarriages or stillbirths, the final of three stillbirths being in 1536, which would have been his first male son. As the years passed without a male heir, Anne's position became increasingly precarious. Whispers began to circulate through the court. Rumors of her alleged infidelities, her sharp tongue, and her reformist religious beliefs made her many enemies. These rumors, whether true or fabricated, provided the ammunition her adversaries needed. In a cruel twist of fate, Anne found herself arrested and taken to the Tower of London, the very place she had once called home as queen. Henry's disillusionment with Anne was profound. His once ardent love for her transformed into a deep-seated resentment. In his fervor to erase the painful memories of their union, he ordered a sweeping removal of any symbols or reminders of Anne from his palaces. Every emblem, every insignia that bore the mark of their union was to be obliterated. It was as though he sought to erase her very existence from his life and from the pages of history. Yet, in the vast expanse of the royal residences, amidst the intricate carvings and lavish decorations, one emblem evaded the eyes of the royal carpenters. In the magnificent Great Hall of the Tower of London, a testament to Henry's once grand love for Anne, a carved H and A remains intertwined. This hall, which was constructed in celebration of Anne's coronation, still stands today as a silent witness to their passionate and tumultuous love affair. In May 1536, after a swift and arguably biased trial held in the very same Great Hall itself, Anne was found guilty of adultery, treason, and other charges. Many historians believe these accusations were trumped up, result of political conspiracies and the king's desire to be free of a wife who could not give him a male heir. On the morning of May 19th, within the cold stone walls of the tower, Anne Boleyn, once the most powerful woman in England, was executed. Hoping for a more noble form of execution for his wife than the axe, Henry sent for a swordsman from France even before she was found guilty. She was executed blindfolded and kneeling. Her final moments were marked with dignity as she met her fate with a grace that belied the brutal nature of her end. Immediately after her execution, Henry boarded a boat and headed to meet wife number three, Jane Seymour. They were betrothed the very next day and married 10 days after that. Once the subject of Henry's obsession for nearly a decade, there was no longer any trace of her whatsoever in his heart. Anne Boleyn's story serves as a poignant reminder of the dangers of absolute power, the fleeting nature of favor, and the high stakes of courtly politics. Her legacy, however, lives on in her daughter, Elizabeth I, who would become one of England's greatest monarchs. One of the most famous ghostly sightings of Anne Boleyn is at the Tower of London, where she was executed. It is said that her apparition has been seen numerous times, wandering the corridors and the chapel of the tower. Witnesses have reported seeing a headless figure, believed to be Anne, walking the tower grounds, holding her severed head under her arm. Another well-documented sighting is the annual procession of Anne Boleyn's ghost at Hever Castle, her childhood home. Every year, on the anniversary of her death, she is said to be seen crossing the bridge over the River Eden towards the castle, dressed in white and floating above the ground. This ethereal vision is accompanied by a chilling atmosphere, and many have reported feeling a sudden drop in temperature when she appears. In addition to these sightings, there have been reports of Anne's ghost at other locations, including Blickling Hall in Norfolk. Here it is believed that Anne returns every year on the anniversary of her execution, arriving in a carriage driven by a headless horseman. She is seen holding her own severed head and is surrounded by flashing lights and loud noises. Even her daughter, the beloved Elizabeth I, didn't escape the dark shadow of the Tower of London and became one of the most dramatic episodes in English history, a poignant chapter in the tumultuous saga of the Tudor dynasty. The year was 1554. England was a nation divided both politically and religiously. At its helm was Mary Tudor, the country's first reigning queen, a staunch Catholic determined to reverse the Protestant reforms initiated by her father, Henry VIII. Her younger half-sister Elizabeth was a stark contrast. Raised in the Protestant faith of her mother, Anne Boleyn, Elizabeth was seen by many as the hope for a Protestant future. It was against this backdrop of religious tension that Elizabeth found herself ensnared in a web of political intrigue. Accused of being involved in a Protestant plot to overthrow Mary, known as Wyatt's Rebellion, Elizabeth became a target of her sister's suspicion and wrath. On March 18, 1554, a 20-year-old Elizabeth was brought to the Tower of London. The journey to the tower was symbolic in its own right. She arrived by the River Thames, the same route taken by her mother, Anne Boleyn, who had been executed at the tower years earlier. The weight of that legacy, the haunting memory of her mother's fate, must have weighed heavily on the young princess's mind. Mary's decision to have Elizabeth brought to the tower by barge was a calculated one. Elizabeth was immensely popular among the English people, and parading her through the streets could have incited sympathy or even rebellion. By ensuring a more discreet arrival, Mary aimed to minimize the risk of public unrest. Elizabeth had penned a heartfelt letter to her sister, pleading her innocence. She implored Mary to believe she had no part in any plot against her. But Mary, perhaps driven by fear, paranoia, or a mix of both, didn't even grant her sister's words a reading. The letter, filled with desperation and hope, went ignored. For Elizabeth, the tower must have felt like a place of despair. The very walls that imprisoned her had witnessed the downfall of her own mother. She had no way of knowing whether she would share her mother's tragic fate, or if she would ever breathe the air of freedom again. As Elizabeth's barge approached the tower, it docked at the Queen's Steps, a location that remains to this day. The weight of the moment must have been crushing. The young princess, who had grown up in the splendor of the royal court, now found herself on the precipice of uncertainty. She hesitated, reluctant to disembark.
"I never thought I would arrive here as a traitor,"
her voice echoing over the water.
"I come in no traitor, but as a true woman to the Queen's Majesty as any is now living."
The gravity of her situation was palpable. As she stepped onto the grounds, she was met with a sea of soldiers, their armor glistening in the sun.
"Are all these soldiers for me?"
she questioned, her voice tinged with disbelief.
"I am but a weak woman."
Yet as she moved past them, a remarkable thing happened. One by one, the soldiers removed their caps, a silent gesture of respect. It was a testament to Elizabeth's popularity, even among those tasked with her imprisonment. Her journey took her beneath the Bloody Tower, a place synonymous with treachery and death, and the location believed to have been home to the young princes now missing. From there, she could still glimpse the scaffold, a chilling reminder of the fate that had befallen her cousin, Lady Jane Grey. The memories, the weight of her lineage, the shadow of her mother, Anne Boleyn, must have pressed heavily on her. Yet Elizabeth was not one to be easily cowed. When presented with the charges against her, she defended herself with such eloquence and conviction that they had to be dropped. Her time in the tower was brief, but the scars of that experience would remain. In a twist of fate laden with irony, Elizabeth's release from the tower coincided with the anniversary of her mother's execution. Anne Boleyn, once the darling of the English court, had met her end on the scaffold, a victim of political machinations and royal whims. As Elizabeth stepped out of the tower, a free woman once more, she was not just walking into her future, but also carrying with her the legacy of her past, a reminder of the fragility of power and the resilience of spirit. The reign of Elizabeth I, the Virgin Queen, is a tapestry of intrigue, power, and passion. 4 centuries later, historians and enthusiasts still dissect her rule, weighing the golden age of art and exploration against the darker threads of political and religious strife. Yet while debates about her reign continue, the fates of those who crossed her are etched in stone and memory. Among the most poignant tales from her reign is that of Robert Devereux, the Earl of Essex, a figure who, with his tall stature, seductive gaze, and dark piercing eyes, captured the heart of the Queen. Despite the vast chasm of age between them, he being 3 decades her junior, he feigned affection, and Elizabeth, perhaps longing for genuine companionship in her later years, was utterly beguiled. She overlooked his glaring flaws, his arrogance, his impetuousness, his fiery temper. But love, especially in the treacherous waters of the Tudor court, is seldom simple. Entrusted with quelling an uprising in Ireland, Devereux brazenly defied Elizabeth's commands, choosing instead to parley with those deemed rebels. His audacity was met with the Queen's wrath. Returning to England in disgrace, his pride undiminished, he made a fateful decision. Rallying a feeble army, which, in a display of almost comedic ineptitude, paused its rebellion for lunch, he sought to rise against the very queen who had once favored him. His rebellion was easily quashed, and Devereux found himself imprisoned in the very tower that now bears his name, the Devereux Tower. The charges against him were grave and the outcome inevitable. Convicted of treason, he was sentenced to die. On a cold February morning in 1601, he was led to the scaffold. Witnesses to his final moments speak of a man filled with regret, lamenting a life squandered in wantonness, lust, and uncleanness. Yet for all his theatrical remorse, the Queen remained unmoved. The executioner's axe fell, and in a grisly testament to the gravity of his crimes, it took 3 attempts to end his life. Robert Devereux holds the grim distinction of being the last person executed within the tower's walls. A mere 2 years later, the Virgin Queen herself would pass away, marking the end of the Tudor dynasty. But the legacy of those tumultuous years and the lives intertwined with Elizabeth's endures. Devereux, along with many others who met tragic ends at the tower, is commemorated in a monument on the grounds and is buried in the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula, a somber reminder of the price of ambition and the fleeting nature of power in the shadow of the crown. For many of us, our first introduction to Sir Walter Raleigh was in the pages of our elementary school history books. A dashing explorer, a favorite of Queen Elizabeth, and the man who, as legend has it, once laid his cloak over a puddle for the Queen. His tales of discovery, of the New World, and of the elusive City of Gold have become the stuff of legend. But what many might not know is the darker chapter of his life. A chapter that unfolded within the cold stone walls of the Tower of London. Upon the death of Queen Elizabeth, the tides of fortune turned for Raleigh. The once favored courtier found himself imprisoned at the Tower. At 51, a man who had once sailed the high seas and enjoyed the favor of the crown was now confined to a cell. The weight of his circumstances bore down on him, and he grappled with intense depression. But Raleigh, ever the innovator, refused to let his spirit be entirely crushed by his confinement. During his 13 long years in the Tower, he transformed his surroundings. He set up a laboratory, delving into the world of herbal medicine. Outside his cell, adjacent to the foreboding Bloody Tower, he cultivated a garden. In this small patch of earth, Raleigh grew a variety of plants, seeking solace in their growth and the promise of nature. Today, over four centuries later, if you were to visit the Tower of London, you'd find a special tribute to his indomitable spirit. In the very spot where Raleigh once tended to his plants, a garden has been meticulously recreated. Using historical records and careful research, the garden has been planted with the same species that Raleigh himself would have grown. In the face of adversity, amidst the cold and shadow of the Tower, life, in the form of Raleigh's plants, found a way to thrive. Raleigh was imprisoned in the Tower not once, but twice. The first time was under Queen Elizabeth I, after he secretly married one of her maids of honor, Elizabeth Throckmorton. However, it was his second imprisonment under King James I that would seal his fate. Accused of being involved in the plot against the king, Raleigh was incarcerated for 13 years. During this time, he wrote his magnum opus, The History of the World. He was eventually executed in 1618 on charges of conspiring against the Spanish. Today, the spirit of Sir Walter Raleigh is said to linger in the very place he spent so many years of his life. Visitors and guards alike have reported seeing his apparition on the battlements of the Tower, an area now known as Raleigh's Walk. It's said that he can be seen pacing back and forth, lost in deep thought, perhaps reflecting on his past adventures or the fate that befell him. Some have even claimed to hear the faint scratching of a quill, as if Raleigh is still working on his writings from the afterlife. But Raleigh's ghost is not just a silent observer. There have been accounts of him interacting with the living. On certain nights, especially when the fog rolls in from the Thames, a few have reported being approached by a tall, bearded figure dressed in Elizabethan attire. He would ask them questions about the current state of the world, or share tales from his voyages, only to vanish into the mist when they turn away. Raleigh's Walk, with its panoramic views of the Thames, is a poignant reminder of the explorer's confinement. It's easy to imagine him gazing out at the river, yearning for the freedom of the open sea and the adventures that once defined his life. The haunting presence of Sir Walter Raleigh at the Tower of London serves as a memory to his indomitable spirit, forever intertwined with the history of this ancient fortress. But But there was also Catherine Howard, once remembered as the tragic young queen and the fifth wife of the formidable King Henry VIII. Born into the powerful Howard family, she was thrust into the political and tumultuous world of the Tudor court at a very young age. With her youthful exuberance, vivacity, and undeniable charm, she quickly caught the eye of the aging king. Their courtship was swift, and Catherine, barely out of her teens, found herself crowned as the Queen of England. But the English court was a place of whispers and shadows. Every move, every glance was watched, analyzed, and often misconstrued. Catherine, with her youthful naivete, was ill-prepared for the treacherous waters of court politics. Her past, which included relationships before her marriage to the king, became a weapon in the hands of her enemies. Whispered rumors turned into formal accusations, and Catherine found herself trapped in a web of conspiracy and betrayal. The charges against her were grave. Accusations of infidelity and premarital relations were not just personal affronts, they were political dynamite. In a world where the sanctity of the royal lineage was paramount, the queen's alleged indiscretions threatened the very foundation of Tudor rule. Catherine's pleas of innocence, her tearful protestations, and even her desperate letters to the king went unheeded. The machinery of the Tudor justice system, once set in motion, was relentless. The Tower of London awaited Catherine. It was here that she would spend her final days, a far cry from the opulent palaces and the adoring courtiers she once knew. Her fate was sealed, and on a cold morning, Catherine Howard, the young queen full of life and promise, was executed at the Tower. Within the tapestry of history, Catherine Howard's narrative emerges as a heart-rending saga of youthful dreams, soaring aspirations, and the steep toll of palace intrigues. Her fleeting existence underscores the labyrinthian perils of navigating the Tudor court's treacherous corridors. One of the most famous ghostly sightings of Catherine is at Hampton Court Palace, specifically in what is now known as the Haunted Gallery. Legend has it that, upon hearing of her arrest, a desperate Catherine broke free from her guards and ran down the gallery towards the chapel where King Henry was at prayer, hoping to plead for her life. She was dragged back screaming to her rooms. To this day, visitors and staff have reported hearing the chilling sounds of screams echoing down the corridor. Some have even claimed to see a ghostly figure of a woman, believed to be Catherine, dressed in white, running down the gallery, reenacting that desperate plea for mercy. Catherine's final days were spent imprisoned in the Tower of London, awaiting her execution. It's said that her spirit still lingers there. Over the years, night guards have reported seeing a ghostly apparition of a lady, often recognized as Catherine, near the place of her execution. Some have even claimed to witness her kneeling as if in prayer, a heartbreaking reminder of her tragic end. Another eerie tale associated with Catherine's ghosts is the sudden and unexplained scent of roses in areas she's believed to haunt. Roses, often associated with love and tragedy, seem a fitting spectral signature for the young queen whose life was cut short due to the matters of the heart. Many visitors to Hampton Court Palace and the Tower of London have reported feeling sudden cold spots, hearing unexplained noises, or feeling an inexplicable sense of sadness or dread. Some believe these sensations are linked to Catherine's restless spirit, still searching for justice, or perhaps forgiveness. But Henry VIII's viciousness wasn't limited just to his own wives. Few tales surrounding Henry are as harrowing as that of Anne Askew. A woman of many firsts, she was a beacon of resilience, faith, and defiance in a time when religious fervor and political intrigue were intertwined. Anne Askew, a woman 24 years old, was not just any woman of her time. She was the first woman to pen a poem in the English language, the first to boldly request a divorce from her husband, and tragically, the first woman to be tortured at the Tower of London for her unwavering Protestant beliefs. In an era where religious convictions could determine one's fate, Anne's staunch Protestantism made her a target for the authorities. In 1546, her beliefs led to her capture and subsequent torture at the Tower. The initial intent was to intimidate her into a confession by merely showing her the gruesome instruments of torture. But Anne's spirit was unyielding. Sir Kingston, the constable of the Tower, found himself in a moral quandary. The very idea of torturing a woman was abhorrent, even in those brutal times. He sought to distance himself from this heinous act, rushing to King Henry to express his refusal to partake in such barbarity. However, in his absence, the others, blinded by their zeal, subjected Anne to the rack. This horrific device stretched her body to such extremes that all her joints separated. The chilling screams that emanated from the Tower that day bore witness and testimony to her agony. Yet, even in the face of such torment, Anne's spirit remained unbroken. She resolutely proclaimed her faith, stating she would rather meet death than betray her beliefs. Her final moments came on July 16th, 1546, at Smithfield Market. Rendered immobile by her torture, she was carried to her execution site. There, she was bound to a chair, chains wrapped around her neck to keep her upright, and set ablaze. The flames took over an hour to claim her life. Today, the very chamber that witnessed Anne's torment has been transformed into a gift shop. Yet within its walls lies the second oldest door in all of England, a witness to the atrocities of the past. Only the door at Westminster Abbey is older. Anne Askew's story is a stark reminder of the price many paid for their beliefs, and the lengths to which power structures would go to suppress dissent. And finally, in the first part of our journey, who could forget Lady Jane Grey, England's nine-day queen? A young woman whose life was shaped by the ambitions of others and whose fate was sealed by the tumultuous politics of her time. Born in 1537, Lady Jane Grey was the eldest daughter of Henry Grey, Duke of Suffolk, and Frances Brandon, the niece of King Henry VIII. From a tender age, Jane exhibited an exceptional intellect. She was fluent in Greek and Latin by her early teens and was well-versed in theology and philosophy. Her education was steeped in the new Protestant faith, which would play a pivotal role in her life. The England of Jane's time was a land rife with religious and political upheaval. The Protestant Reformation had set the stage for a power struggle between the Catholics and the newly formed Church of England. Jane's Protestant faith and her royal blood made her a valuable pawn in this game of thrones. In the turbulent times of the Tudor dynasty, the health of the young King Edward was a matter of grave concern. At just 15 years old, he was gravely ill, suffering from tuberculosis. Many whispered that John Dudley, the Duke of Northumberland, who remained ever present by the young king's side, might have been slowly poisoning him. The looming question of succession cast a shadow over the kingdom. King Edward, as Henry VIII's only son, was the natural heir to the throne. However, with no other male successors, the line of succession would naturally fall to Mary, Edward's elder half-sister. But this presented a significant challenge. Mary was a devout Catholic, and there were concerns about the religious direction she might take the country in. In a desperate bid to ensure the continuation of Protestant rule, King Edward, on his deathbed, made a decision that would forever alter the course of English history. He drafted a new will, bypassing his half-sisters and naming his cousin, Lady Jane Grey, as his successor. Lady Jane, also a Protestant, was ironically married to Lord Guildford Dudley, the son of John Dudley, due to the machinations of the Duke of Northumberland himself. The Duke's influence over the ailing king was evident. He persuaded Edward to name Lady Jane, his own daughter-in-law, as the next queen. This monumental decision was shrouded in such secrecy that even Lady Jane was unaware of her newfound status as heir to the throne. Days after King Edward's passing, Lady Jane was informed of her destiny. With ambitions of consolidating power within his family, John Dudley swiftly moved to action, ushering his son and Lady Jane to the Tower of London. The Duke of Northumberland had masterfully orchestrated a coup, placing the crown within his own family's grasp. On July 10th, 1553, Lady Jane Grey was proclaimed Queen of England. The Duke of Northumberland's meticulous plan to place his daughter-in-law on the throne seemed to be unfolding seamlessly. As she journeyed to the Tower by barge from Richmond, her husband, Guildford Dudley, accompanied her. Given her lineage and Protestant faith, one might have expected her to be embraced by the populace. However, the reality was starkly different. The majority of the country was in the dark about this sudden change in succession. The whispers and murmurs began. Why Jane? Why not Princess Mary, the legitimate heir and King Edward's half-sister? The confusion was intense, and the Duke's plan began to show its cracks. Adding fuel to the fire was Guildford Dudley's blatant disregard for royal protocol. As they disembarked from the barge, he walked ahead of Jane, a mere teenager and the proclaimed queen, displaying a sense of entitlement that did not sit well with the onlookers. His connection to the widely despised Duke of Northumberland only further tainted public perception. Meanwhile, Mary was not a passive player in this game for the throne. She rallied her supporters, leveraging her legitimate claim and the public's affection for her. The momentum shifted rapidly in her favor, and the nobility, sensing the changing winds, began to rally behind her. In a dramatic turn of events, just 9 days after Jane's proclamation, Mary was declared the rightful Queen of England. The brief reign of Lady Jane Grey, often referred to as the 9 Days Queen, came to a tragic end. Once ensconced in the royal apartments, surrounded by the trappings of power and luxury, Lady Jane's world was turned upside down in the blink of an eye. The palace that had been a symbol of her newfound status was transformed into her prison. The uncertainty of her fate weighed heavily on her, as she was confined to the jailer's quarters, overlooking the ominous Tower Green where her destiny would be sealed. Meanwhile, her husband, Guildford Dudley, and his brothers were incarcerated in the Beauchamp Tower. This structure, known for its defensive prowess, was reserved for the most elite and high-profile prisoners. But what sets the Beauchamp Tower apart is the poignant graffiti etched into its walls. These carvings, made by desperate hands, tell tales of hope, despair, and defiance. One such carving stands out. John Dudley, Guildford's elder brother, was determined to ensure that their legacy would not be forgotten. With painstaking precision, he etched their family emblems and coat of arms into the stone, symbols of their lineage and pride. Each flower represented one of the Dudley brothers, a silent tribute to their unity and strength. At the center of this intricate design was John's name, boldly proclaiming his presence and significance in time. The weight of their father's execution, a mere month after their imprisonment, must have been crushing. The shadow of the executioner's axe loomed large, and the fear of meeting a similar fate was ever present. Yet even in their darkest hour, the Dudley brothers exhibited a spirit of defiance. Their carvings, still visible today, serve as a lasting reminder of their courage, determination, and will to survive. The cold winds of November 1553 swept through the streets of London, carrying with them an air of tension and foreboding. The city was abuzz with whispers and murmurs as the fate of Lady Jane Grey and the Dudley brothers was to be decided. Queen Mary, in a calculated move to assert her authority and humiliate those who had dared to challenge her, chose to parade them through the streets of London. Instead of the relative privacy and dignity of a barge journey, they were made to walk over a mile to the Guildhall, exposed to the jeers, taunts, and scorn of the public. The Guildhall, a symbol of the city's power and authority, was packed to the rafters. The atmosphere was thick with anticipation as the accused were brought forth. The charges were grave, treason, an offense punishable by death. The very act of challenging the rightful heir to the throne was seen as an affront to the monarchy, the divine order, and the very fabric of English society. One by one, they stood before the tribunal, the weight of their actions and the gravity of their situation evident in their faces. Each of them, realizing the futility of resistance, pleaded guilty. The verdict was swift and unanimous. They were condemned of high treason. As they were led out of the Guildhall, a chilling symbol accompanied them. An official, bearing an axe, walked ahead. The blade of the axe, gleaming coldly in the winter sun, faced the prisoners. It was a stark and morbid message to the onlookers. These individuals were marked for execution. The very sight of the axe served as a grim reminder of the price of challenging the crown, and the inexorable fate that awaited those who did. Once returned to the tower, Lady Jane would never leave its haunting embrace again. The cold, bleak morning of February 12, 1554, dawned with an air of somber finality. The Tower of London, which had stood witness to countless tales of power, betrayal, and death, was once again the stage for a tragic drama. The anniversary of this day is still remembered with a solemn ceremony in the chapel within the tower's walls. Lady Jane Grey, the 9 days queen, stood by the window of her prison cell, her gaze fixed on the grim spectacle unfolding below her. The chilling sight of her husband, Lord Guildford Dudley, being led to Tower Hill would have been etched in her mind. The return of his lifeless, bloodied body, his severed head wrapped in a somber cloth, was a harrowing prelude to her imminent fate. The scaffold, a grim symbol of her impending doom, was being erected just within her line of sight. Yet despite the horrifying reality of her situation, Lady Jane remained composed. Those who were with her during her final hours spoke of her serene acceptance of her fate, a tranquility rooted in her deep faith and unwavering belief in a higher power. As she was led to the scaffold, the gathered crowd watched in hushed silence. Ascending the steps, she addressed them.
"Good people, I am come hither to die."
Her voice, though steady, carried the weight of her young life's tragedies. She continued with grace, her words devoid of anger or bitterness. However, the sight of the axeman, the harbinger of her imminent end, momentarily broke her composure.
"I pray you, dispatch me quickly,"
she implored. As she knelt, the blindfold obscuring her vision, a moment of panic set in.
"What shall I do? Where is it?"
she cried out, disoriented and unable to find the block. A kind soul from the gathered crowd stepped forward, guiding her trembling hands to the cold, hard wood. Laying herself down, she uttered her final prayer.
"Lord, into thy hands I commend my spirit."
With those words, the tragic tale of Lady Jane Grey reached its poignant conclusion. Lady Jane Grey's life, though brief, left a mark on English history. She is remembered not for her reign, but for her intellect, her piety, and her tragic fate. Among the Tower of London's most haunting specters is the ethereal presence of Lady Jane Grey, England's ill-fated 9 days queen. On the very battlements of the tower, a spectral figure is said to emerge every year on the 12th of February, the anniversary of her execution. This sad, young apparition, dressed in the attire of the Tudor era, is believed to be Lady Jane, her gaze forever fixed on a horizon she'd never reach. The Tower Green, where she met her tragic end, is steeped in an aura of sorrow. Visitors often speak of sudden cold drafts and faint, prayerful whispers that seem to resonate with her final moments. The Beauchamp Tower exudes a palpable sense of despair, with some claiming to glimpse a young woman's silhouette, forever gazing out, perhaps in hope of rescue. And in the hallowed grounds of the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula, where her mortal remains are laid to rest, a serene yet melancholic spirit is felt. Whether one believes in these spectral tales or not, they underscore the profound impact of Lady Jane Grey's brief life, a poignant reminder of a young queen ensnared in the treacherous webs of Tudor politics. Reflecting on the life of Lady Jane Grey, I can't help but feel a deep sense of sorrow and injustice. Here was a young woman, brimming with intelligence, potential, and a keen understanding of the world around her. In another time, under different circumstances, she might have been one of England's most enlightened and progressive rulers. Instead, she became a pawn in a deadly game of power and ambition, manipulated by those who could have protected her. It's heartbreaking to think of Lady Jane, a mere teenager, thrust into the highest position of power, only to be cruelly snatched away from it. She wasn't just deprived of her title, she was robbed of her life. And for what? For being a perceived threat to the ambitions of cunning men who saw her not as a human being with dreams, hopes, and fears, but as a mere tool to further their own ends. Her story is a stark reminder of the countless souls throughout history, and even today, who find themselves imprisoned, persecuted, or silenced, not for any wrongdoing on their part, but simply because their very existence challenges the status quo. They are the voices that dare to speak out, the spirits that refuse to be broken, the lives that, despite all odds, shine brightly in the face of adversity. It's a call to look and honor not just her, but all those who have been wronged, forgotten, or overwritten. It took centuries for her to receive even a semblance of the recognition she deserved. Let it be a lesson to all of us to ensure that the voices of the oppressed are heard, their stories told, and their memories honored in our time. As the years rolled on, the Tower of London, with its imposing presence, continued to evolve, reflecting the ambitions and fears of the monarchs who ruled over England. In the heart of London, the tower stands, not just as stone and mortar, but as a tapestry woven with tales of ambition, love, betrayal, and valor. It's more than a monument. It's a chronicle, echoing with whispers from centuries past. Each shadowed nook, each cobbled path murmurs secrets of kings and queens, of heroes and villains, of the celebrated and the forgotten. Yet as we pause in our narrative, know this: our journey through the tower's labyrinthian history is only half told. Its walls continue to beckon, urging us to delve deeper, to unearth more of its enigmas, to listen ever closer to its age-old tales. In our ensuing episode, we'll traverse further into this emblematic bastion. We'll witness its many evolutions, meet the unwavering sentinels who've borne its legacy, gaze upon the treasures it jealously guards, and tiptoe through legends that still dance in its moonlit courtyards. So as twilight drapes the tower, painting its stones in shades of amber and obsidian, we take a breath, a brief respite. But the tale is not done. Stay with us as we continue to weave the narrative, unspooling the threads of time and revealing the very essence of a nation enshrined within the Tower of London.